Good afternoon and welcome to Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on Eagle FM. We are not having, let me just say me. I'm not having a good time today because, let me just say, ever since the camera showed up, now I can't hide my, you know, my bad headache.
Why are you worried about the cameras?
Come again?
Why are you worried about the cameras?
Well, when I was a kid, I was diagnosed with something called camera phobias, the irrational fear of, you know, of cameras. I just made that up.
I know you made it up.
Well, thank you. Wherever you tuned in, thank you for tuning in. Thank you for tuning to Eagle FM, Home Run, your favorite duo here on Eagle FM. On your drive time show, that is Home Run, bringing you one topic after another. You know, we just do it like DJ Khaled. Monday to Friday, we're just going another one. And yesterday, it was just one short show. I went home with like 70% of my content.
Okay.
Now today is just the usual Home Run, that is with basically 2 hours. And today's subject is somewhat similar to similar to yesterday's topic in a lot of ways. So one, it's it's a developmental in it's developmental in scope and also global in scope. And today's show and yesterday's show was they're both based on a report from the same institution, that's the International Energy Agency. Yesterday it was it was based on the 2026 look at the global electric vehicles, where they looked at a number of things. The first thing they looked at was basically the adoption of the technology in terms of mode of transport globally, in terms of manufacturing and emerging market in terms of consumption, aka those that are buying and those that are venturing into the manufacturing aspect of the technology. Now today's discussion is centered around just energy, and one thing about yesterday's discussion was it was also very
energy investment.
Energy investment, yeah, energy investment.
It's how much money
you put into.
Yeah. Basically.
Well, Africa is always on the receiving end of these things, but don't worry, I will catch you up, you know, with yesterday. So, energy investment.
Actually, with yesterday, even though I wasn't here, just to let the listeners know, I was knocked down by some weird flu. When I read the report, Helmut.
Yeah.
When I read the report, it was literally shocking to see no mention of Africa on electric vehicle production, electric vehicle trend analysis, electric vehicle adoption, electric vehicle infrastructure expansion, 0.0.0.0. So the downside of what happens is that literally it looks like we in Africa, we're not in any new technological trend developments. It doesn't seem like we are even on the bridge of getting to the latest consumer technologies associated specifically to new frontier technologies. It's just shocking, Howard. And that's just the electric vehicle of yesterday. That's all it is. Just vehicles.
When I said we are on the receiving end of, when I said we're always on the receiving end, because when you compare yesterday's report on EVs and today's report on just the energy investment, there's one thing both reports have in common is that they zone in on energy. And that's not surprising because, well, considering the source. The thing is, it's the International Energy Agency, so.
Considering the source. Well, they are based in Europe. You know.
That's one thing.
Yeah.
You see, just there to point that out.
Well, they are based in Europe. There's nothing we can do.
They are.
Yeah. It's not like they were based in Africa and specifically, voila, you know, they talk about from an Africa-centric. The unfortunate thing is Africa is not even on the scale of processing, refinement, which comes back to that other question I asked you, Helmut. When that copper leaves Namibia and Zambia here at the port of Walvis Bay, does it go across the street in Walvis Bay to be auctioned off to the refiners or the other processors or the other, what do they call those people? The other buyers and users and users before it gets to consumers, or does it have first have to sail to London or this way around to, what's that other place's name? The other metals exchange, I think it's the Shanghai one. Does it have to go to those places first to be assessed, and then it gets sold to the known customers? Because that is Africa's issue. Africa has to be the frontier. Remember what Bomkele Mene said? We must stop being the potential. We must stop with this potential labeling. Because potentials means...
We have the potential.
Okay, it's for Helmut's children tomorrow. Okay, it's for Dwight's children next year. It doesn't speak about what Helmut and Dwight can do today. How Helmut and Dwight can participate today. And he is unfortunately right, Helmut. He is unfortunately right. Because when we also look at this energy investment report, remember, guys, it helps with the EV consumption discussion. Well... safe to say that once again it's the global hubs, should we rather say, the centralized hubs that keep dominating the discussion once again. And us as Africans, we are just singing Kumbaya, come by here, my lord. Actually, it's not Kumbaya, it's come by here. Sorry, Hamlet. I didn't intend to show up with jokes today.
Do you have any idea how long it took me to understand that Kumbaya is actually a pigeonized version of come by here?
Yeah. And the funny thing is there, everybody sings it.
Well, the thing is, look, after I found out that komot means get out, then I just realized that. There's no beating these guys. It's them.
Come out. What? Komot is come out.
Komot. Get out. Look, that's pigeon
English. Really have to watch from... Do you know what's the funniest thing that you talk about pigeon English there? Our colleague Matthias, back in last week, he shared a post from, was it BBC Nigeria? But it literally says BBC pigeon.
They have a BBC pigeon version of it.
And,
just read that thing.
And Matthias's response was like, I don't understand what's being said. I told him, dude, it's pigeon English.
Just translate.
Don't attempt. It's pigeon English. Don't attempt anything.
Look, it's a very wonderful English, but look.
It's not.
Look, it's... look,
it's read that thing?
Look, it's wonderful English. It's look, for me, it's pigeon and patois. I love those two.
Well, okay, Patois is Mr. Jamaican one.
Yeah, the weed one. Yeah. Look, the main difference...
The weed one?
Okay, that was uncalled for. But
if you're listening to us anywhere around the world, since Eagle FM can be reached digitally...
Well, then I start a diplomatic incident.
Helmut said that. Helmut said if you're from Jamaica or from the West Indies, Helmut said that you've got weed English. I'm sorry, guys.
You have okay now. Look,
Helmut. No one will. They might voodoo you from the other side of the world. At least you know that you've got the ancestors here, and they've just got basic witchcraft.
Yeah. Look, man, I'm a Gavango. That's the least of my worry. But look,
so you're at the heart of witchcraft
headquarters.
Look, we were still on energy investment there. We were still on energy investment there.
But all right. Yeah. Now let's just point out one thing about these energy investments. One thing that I found in the International Energy Agency report, and that's all the way to the bottom of the report. Yeah. One thing that they do point out is they basically point out sort of like a summary of how they what they look at in terms of investment in the energy line of work, and they are doing this globally, hence their international investment. So something I found interesting was that this is what they point out, that the International Energy Agency measures investment as an ongoing capital spending on assets. For some sectors such as power generation, this investment is spread out from year in which the new plant or upgrade. So they also factor in renovation or expansion of an existing energy infrastructure. Or upgrade of an existing or existing one takes a final investment decision to the year in which it becomes operational. So they are following it all the way through. Now, if there is one thing that if there is one thing that they pointed out during the energy security summit of the future was that 2024-2025 January. As the one that was held in London. Mm-hmm. One thing they pointed out was to attract investment for a lot of countries, especially the developing ones, to attract investment in the energy sector, they first have to to ensure that they have an investment environment that is secure, because energy infrastructure in terms of investment, because the infrastructure takes years to build. You don't just build. Take for example, a traditional nuclear power plant in 6 months or 1 year. You know, it takes a very long time, and all that time, obviously, you want as an investor, like anyone else, that basically likes money. And want their money back, in whatever venture they're investing in, into. What that leads to is you have to create an environment that is safe for investment, so that anyone can basically put their money in that invest in the energy development or energy infrastructure in your country without worrying about some general taking over office the next day, and then they lose their entire investment because the guy comes into power and then dissolves the constitution, terminates all kinds of agreements that the previous administration signed. So political instability, is very significant. It's a very important discussion to have when we're talking about long-term investments. Now, that's one. So that means if the International Energy Agency now, and the way that they look at energy investment the world over is from the moment that the investment is started, or the expansion of an existing energy infrastructure is started, they start tracking the investment from there, or all the way through to the day that the whole situation, the whole facility is basically switched on, or is deemed operational. And that's going to take a while. Now, the Gulf conflict, I don't like to use the word Middle East because we are not in the West, which I find weird. Wait, should we say Southeast Asia?
Well, okay, you can't say Southeast, because Southeast Helmut is literally where Vietnam them are.
Yeah.
Then you have South Asia, which is literally from India. Okay, pull it from Pakistan into Indonesia and what's that other country? Malaysia and
all the island nations.
Yeah. So. And Southeast Asia is basically from Vietnam to Cambodia to Laos and Philippines and Thailand.
That would be Southwest.
Okay.
And you still have to stretch it from India.
Hence the reason they call it Middle East, because it's between it's between Turkey, which no one knows where Turkey is, because they don't know where to put Turkey.
Isn't Turkey just in Europe?
Well. Turkey is not fully allowed into Europe, but Turkey is in Europe, but Turkey doesn't want to be in the Middle East, but Turkey literally borders onto the Middle East. And then you've got the Caucasus, which is those guys just here below, between Iran, Iraq, and Syria, which is the all those stands that were in the Soviet Union, plus Georgia. And then they are the Caucasus, and then you've got Russia. And then the whole discussion out of that is literally, so the Middle East technically is, and you've got Egypt here, which is part of Africa.
Yeah.
So if you look at that scenario with the Indian Ocean, that means it's middle and east. It's middle, stuck somewhere, and eastward somewhere.
So in other words, for us, it will be what? Middle north? Because if we say north, now you're talking about the Scandinavian countries.
But you know that us Africans, we just call it the Arabic nations.
Yeah, sure. Let's go with the Arabic countries.
Because if we say, but that's also the thing, if we say Arabic, that also includes the whole North Africa.
Yeah, the whole of North Africa, Tunisia, Egypt, Morocco.
After Morocco.
Yeah.
So we also can't say the Arabic.
So the African Union should look into that, because the whole thing ends up being a misnomer of some sort.
Yeah.
So the one thing that was also pointed out in the report was the how the projections that were made, because the report is based on information that was gathered before February 28th.
Yeah.
Yeah. Before that. Now, so that means that this information was based on on projections that, before Donald Trump's and Netanyahu's foreign policy disrupted pretty much everything, and with the block and block mathematics. So, and they also point out on their website, that's the International Energy Agency, that, the shock in terms of the global energy sector that will emanate from the Israeli-Iran and the US war is yet to be measured and basically documented. That's basically in due course. So now we are sitting here with basically the same way that we were with our the national budget unveiling.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is how much money, how much money we have spent. This is how much money has been allocated to this ministry and this agency. And this is where we want to go, economically as a country. And then, some disruptions outside the control of a small country economically and both in political influence like Namibia. It now pops up all these things like the war in the Middle East. Now that's causing all these disruptions. Yeah. So that means we will have to recalculate everything.
But okay, it's mainly based upon, they call it, the IEA calls it here, the energy crisis, the current energy crisis. And in the report of the EV, the one of yesterday that we looked at, minus Dwight. In the EV scenario, it is literally based upon people realizing, consumers realizing that having your economy plus your transportation being dependent upon something that can immediately eat away your financing as a consumer, meaning it eats into your pocket for your daily travels. It also eats into your pocket for everything else in terms of where you wish to spend your money on, is a concern. And people have realized specifically that looking at just fossil fuels as being the energy of the now, being the energy of the now is problematic in terms of that it can quickly escalate. For example, if the US and Iran don't like each other. Sorry about that, guys. That's what I mean about, just missing one day and then you have to rediscover your voice again.
You should have stayed some more, man.
Well, I didn't realize that my voice would run that dry.
That
two minutes into an explainer. If you look at a scenario literally that comes from misaligned geopolitics, because this is what all the academics are now talking about, the misalignment of geopolitics.
Yeah.
We were made to believe specifically, let me put it this way, Almond, that the US means good for all of us. But in the moment when the US realizes that certain things are not going its way anymore, that everybody now says, or meaning other countries, the other 200 plus countries are now saying, listen, we want to do our own thing. We want to achieve our own destinies.
We want to run our own economies.
Yeah. A lot of chaos emanated from the COVID pandemic. A lot of chaos emanated from the Great Recession, as they are calling it, which is 2008-2009. And for the rest of the world to realize the effects of the Great Depression, which was 10 years long,
Yeah.
Many countries are just realizing, you know what? This unipolar discussion just doesn't suit us because it doesn't strengthen each country's position when a crisis actually happens.
Yeah.
So in essence, this then trickles down into what you now see manifesting in terms of consumers realizing, but you know what? This petrol car thing is just, it's just rubbish. It chows into your pocket. Now it's spiked EVs. Now it means consumers are now asking local politicians and policymakers, listen, develop more electric vehicle infrastructure. China is the only market that cooled down. But all other major consumption markets, because for some reason Africa is just one big vacuum of no information. All the other markets, literally, even Latin America, literally had increases in electric vehicle purchases for 2025 only. Because obviously it desists that way. This year still has to finish. So, yeah. In essence, the geopolitics is not in line with real world economic situations. Plus, the geopolitics also doesn't understand and take into consideration the continuous economic pressures that everyone else experiences on a daily basis. Guys, flu is not nice, but yeah.
Okay. Turn on your Wi-Fi on your phone.
On my phone?
Uh-huh.
Okay. My Wi-Fi is on my phone.
Really?
Yeah, it's always on.
No, all right.
Yeah.
The reason why I pointed out that Africa is always on the receiving end of of these things is
UNDP has a Reddit page.
As a Reddit page?
Was it a Reddit page?
Because
Reddit is like, oh no,
that's
so
just
the
UNDP.
Yeah, sorry, I read Reddit.
Oh yeah, Reddit. Yeah. I was gonna wonder. Wait, UN Reddit. That
Reddit,
is, not
Reddit is the worst, bro. don't ever go on Reddit.
Been there, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Start with the Associated Press article, and then you can come to the UNDP one.
Yeah.
And they are all based both articles are based on one thing: energy investment on the African continent. But one thing that the articles basically pick out one source of energy, more like one, let's just call it not one source of energy, one sub branch of energy, because you have two main ones. You have renewable and non-renewable. The two articles, both from the Associated Press and the United Nations Development Program, they're based on Africa's challenge accessing investment. Now, remember during the 2015 Paris agreements, a lot of developed countries, one of the things that developed countries pointed out was something that I believe is very noble. And okay, yes, pardon me. We have got to transition from non-renewable to renewable sources of energy. But not all countries have the economic capacity to carry out that transition, to carry that heavy burden of that transition on their own. So then one of the agreement that was made was that developed countries will have to help in terms of investment, developing countries in their transition.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, one thing they did not see was how the credit rating agencies for a lot of corporate entities that will want to carry the investment and the developing countries that they will be doing these investments in. Now, one thing that both Associated Press and the UNDP are pointing out is that this credit ratings is now hindering a lot of investors from investing into developing countries, because a lot of these developing countries have terrible credit ratings. And now that on its own wouldn't be a problem, because you have an entity that has an excellent credit rating, AAA, and the country that it wants to invest into the country that it wants to invest into has a terrible credit rating. Now, the credit rating is terrible in a sense that even if an entity has an excellent credit rating, when it's investing in a country that has a terrible credit rating, its credit rating is brought to the level of that country that it's operating into.
Yeah.
So, I mean, who in their right mind would want to drop their credit rating just in the name of investment?
Well, here's the other thing also, Helmut. And this is also sometimes like what we've seen with the Kenya thing that you mentioned about the America First Health Bill.
Yeah.
Or the America First
Global Health Strategy.
Global Health Strategy.
Yeah.
Which basically speaks towards bypassing, let's call them middlemen for now, but these multilateral platforms like UN and IMF and World Bank.
Yeah.
Because that's just what Marco Rubio has said many times. They want to do away with these middlemen situations.
Yeah.
But it's middlemen that they created. Them, America, created these guys. It's their institutions.
Yeah, it is their financial institutions.
Yeah, their banks back up the IMF.
Yeah.
It's their banks through which the money is loaned out to Africans.
Yeah.
So now, the same credit ratings that is separate from the IMF guys.
Yeah.
is being used by the IMF and the World Bank guys literally to judge, let's say, Namibia's credit rating.
Yeah.
Now, this makes things problematic because Standard & Poor, Fitch, what's the other one's name? There's three of them. Standard & Poor, Fitch, and Moody's. These three guys basically all... They go and access the IMF World Bank data to see
which country is safe to invest into in terms of so they basically look at their credit ratings, how they are rated.
Basically,
then that's what they make their investment decision on.
Yeah. Now, at the start of every year, Helmut, your Ministry of Finance gets a visit. Your Ministry of Finance, your central bank, and there's someone else, and your National Planning Commission. Every start of a calendar year, our guys get visits from IMF and World Bank.
Okay, so not every start of a financial year, it's every start of a calendar year.
Basically
in January, February, somewhere around there.
Literally because in February, we're going to have our budget unveiling.
Yeah.
So in January, between November/December to January the next year, there's these visits.
Yeah.
And Namibia has these visits every year. Yes, Namibia has these visits every year, guys. Now, and guess where I find out about this, Helmut? I find out about it on the World Bank, on the IMF website about Namibia's particular, they call it the country reports.
Yeah.
About Namibia's particular country reports and or country assessments. And every year they have these, or every 2 years. But every year, every 2 years, doesn't matter, they have these visits to the countries. The thing is, it's that information that the credit rating agencies use to judge a country's credit rating. And it gets judged in US dollars. The aim is what you look at a credit rating for and the investment climate discussion for is literally opposite of AFCFTA's goals. We've been preaching on the continent about AFCFTA, achieving AFCFTA, growing closer through AFCFTA, making AFCFTA work. But this particular discussion highlights the UNDP one and the AP one, highlights specifically Africa has to look at international markets for financing.
Yeah.
But we still have the money here, Helmut. We have the money here. Back in last year, you and I, we highlighted through that medium-term expenditure framework that Namibia had achieved a healthy rate of above 50% of finding the money within Namibia by the government itself to spend for development projects for the government itself. Green hydrogen is associated to an investor-driven discussion. Oil and gas is associated with an investor-driven discussion. So that means government financial involvement is literally to the lowest of risk frameworks. Now, I don't know if the Namibian government wants to run some of these, or participate in some of these things, because Namibians are asking the Namibian government, why is your level of investment so low, or your level of participation is literally on the fence.
Yeah.
Is literally at the fence level, but it's supposed to be, the resources are supposed to be for us. So technically, what Namibians see is Namibians realize that a situation is just purely, what's that word? It looks like pure window dressing, specifically to say that, you know, the resources are meant for us Namibians. But when you look at actual involvement, you know, it's almost, it's literally just a phone call situation. Your only investment is, your only involvement, not investment, is phone call deep. That's it. That's literally it. Phone call deep. It then takes this credit rating discussion to the next level, because in essence, Helmut, you have to ask the question, the question about, what these credit ratings mean specifically to the, for a country like Namibia. Let's say to a country like, but we can't use Namibia. Namibia is too squeaky clean, man. We are just too good of an example.
Okay, you're going to have to explain the squeaky clean part.
Well, first and foremost, look at, for example, look at the massive loophole from the America First Global Health Strategy.
Yeah.
Now, how can you call a global health strategy America First? Firstly. But that's an American thing. The thing is already active. The downside was that the Kenyan president saw there was an easy way to just access financing to help the Kenyan government's financing needs.
Yeah.
In comparing that to Namibia, Namibia is slowly, and slowly but in a minimalist manner, trying to improve its own public health outreach. The downside is, Helmut, we still have to understand to which extent is it being improved on. Is it hiring more people? I mean, it took Namibia the better part of 20 years to realize it needed its own medical school. It took Namibia 20 years. When a country becomes independent, Helmut, a country should realize it needs its own engineers, its own lawyers, its own doctors, its own nurses, because you can't just train a doctor and not have nurses. There is care that takes place.
Yeah.
You can't just have health but no care. You know, you can't just have the doctor showing up with a tablet and saying, "You sure?" You need the nurse that needs to help.
That doctor is going to be overwhelmed.
Of course. Definitely. That doctor is going to be overwhelmed. You can't just have teachers without school facilities. Because, I mean, our colleague Anna Kletter did that wonderful story last year in Dama North, outside Rundu, which is about 6 kilometers outside Rundu, where she explained basically it's volunteers that realize, because because this community literally lives so remotely away from Rundu, the parents literally asked a few people that have an idea of teaching or have teaching experience in Rundu,
yeah,
to basically volunteer for them. That was community buy-in, community coming together, community needs being realized by a community, not by a politician, by literally a community saying, "We are busy having kids here. We need
We want them to have access to education.
And we need certain services."
Yeah.
And that is what happened. Suddenly you see the Prime Minister, there was the Prime Minister and the Minister of Education showing up last year to Indama North. Why? They knew that these people were living there. The local authorities knew the people were living there.
Yep.
However, I'm deviating greatly from the question that you asked in terms of why Namibia is too squeaky clean a picture. Well, first and foremost, that stunt we pulled last year by paying back the Eurobond. Namibia has the potential, Emma, to go and borrow money, to pay back money it borrowed. How many years back? Namibia has the potential to do something like that. Even though that AP article literally says only Botswana and Mauritius have the squeakiest and cleanliest of credit ratings.
Yeah.
Namibia is in the other 52 category of countries, supposedly, that doesn't have such good credit rating. But we had the ability to go and borrow money from a market and pay back another loan.
Yeah.
So Namibia has the potential. So this also means, Amut, when you look at the discussion of narrative, narratives are slightly dangerous. Reason why I keep fixating on narrative. Truth and fact and then narrative. Because truth is based upon whose perspective. Fact is, no one can dispute a fact. The sky is blue. If you see blue, I see blue, we all see blue. We can't deny it. Except at the end of the day when it starts becoming orange-based, you know, situations.
That and when you're high. That's a whole different discussion.
How did you get to the high hell?
Maybe that's because we've been talking about the sky. facts and narrative.
So, the facts, narrative, and a discussion. Now, what that AP guy is highlighting there is...
Yeah.
So, he's basically going to tell an investor in Europe who's reading AP News...
Yeah.
Africa is just, it's just
not safe to invest.
It's just bad loans. But you and I know in Namibia.
Join us for the Ehangano Concert Volume 2 with Ali Tobias. Experience an unforgettable evening featuring songs from her latest album, A Bilo, performed live with a full band. Special guest appearances by Tate Buti, DA, Paige, and One Accord. All proceeds from the event will go towards supporting the Our Lady Orphanage. The event takes place on 4 July 2026 at the National Theatre of Namibia. Tickets are available on Web Tickets Namibia for 450 Namibian dollars. Don't miss this powerful night of music, inspiration, and giving back. Ehangano Concert Volume 2. See you there.
Lipura nengeno wapubwa Eva tere ulikoni maundu tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku tete ofoye ekukulile oshafafana nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doili nawa nune uto otukwetira o special angeta shake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijabo ili nawa ninge fata fanona monika ko Eagle FM onora esatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile konderewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu hatatu oma felane Eagle FM the eye.
Welcome back. If you just tuned in, this is a home run with Helmed and Dwight on Eagle FM. And wherever you tuned in from, you are listening to your favorite duo, your favorite drive time show this time of the day. And of course, we're going until 6, Monday to Friday. Okay, from yesterday until further notice, Monday is just going to be an hour. But for Tuesday all through to Friday, it's just the usual 2 hours, same time, same place. That's an Eagle FM from 4 to 6. So investor somewhere in Europe looking at African countries' investment credit ratings.
So now someone who's not on the ins or is not participating in the investment framework of things just goes and sits with this negative perception of Namibia, not of Namibia, but of the whole African continent, which originally basically is there already. This is a discussion once again that Africa can't manage itself. And
the
funny thing is, Helmut, I actually watched a documentary about that perception about why do people think that of Africa. I can't remember if it was DW documentary was another platform, but they literally said, who created this narrative?
Didn't we have a discussion like that? Was that last year or earlier this year?
I think it was earlier this year, at the start of this year. You also mentioned it specifically where you read about they use imaging of hungry kids.
That was Trevor Noah set.
Yeah, but and then they use it in...
Where they even train flies.
No, how train flies.
1, 2, 3, action.
But It's a discussion of the imaging that also takes place. And you're a Namibian in Africa. You would ask yourself, it's a, my country doesn't look like this. What Africa do these people talk about?
That's the, look, the thing is, I'll come back to my point later. Let's just go to the UNDP, to the UNDP article. Just go to paragraph 1, 2, 3, the fourth paragraph, the one under what led developing countries to borrow on a capital markets. And this is what they point out. Just bear with me. This is going to take a little while. Now, for developing countries, issuing Eurobonds and accessing the global capital market is relatively a new endeavor. Traditionally, concessional loans from multilateral organizations like the World Bank or the Development Bank or a development bank was the usual approach. However, with more African countries graduating from at least developing countries LDC status and having limited access to concessional financing, now commercial loans and a bond issuance are now more common. So it's that upgrade that we were pissed about.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the more you obviously graduate in terms of developmental ranking, the more you now have the least I think the more strict the requirements are for your country to borrow money.
Yeah.
So that means you now have to create obviously the investment environment which is basically a brilliant idea to open up, the investment environment. Now, the thing is now you have been upgraded to a certain level of development, but your credit rating is somewhat still questionable. Now, and the thing is, the article, the UNDP article, one thing that they point out is, even, it's not just unfair, but one thing they point out is that how biased at least they think some of the, some of the ratings are.
Yeah.
Just, for developing countries.
Just two paragraphs down from that paragraph you read.
Yeah.
It literally says in the last line there. The biasness.
The fact that this is something that is coming from, the fact that this is something that's coming from the United Nations Development Program.
I'm glad the UNDP is also starting to roll up its own shirt sleeves to also become, honest in perspective, not just in information, but honest in perspective. Let me read that last sentence to you, Amit, that I'm now speaking about. So, going down, because you can literally skip the next paragraph, which just basically explains the relationship, né?
Yeah.
So they basically say the relationship between a country, a developing country, let's say Namibia, the international investor, not even a local investor, the international investor, and the ratings agency is literally one that the ratings agency has to generate an opinion which is supposed to be unbiased, uninfluenced, about this developing country's particular credit worthiness, meaning ability to pay back. And the investor looks to that ratings agency and asking, what is your opinion about Namibia? Then Moody's, Fitch, or Standard & Poor would generate their opinions about Namibia. But here's the crux of the matter, and this is why I love what the UNDP says in this, in the next paragraph.
Yeah.
Last sentence, I'm going to read it out. However, whilst the issuer pays for the rating to be created, meaning the issuer of a bond, which is the country, Namibia pays in some way for the rating to be created. Known as the issuer pays, the credit rating agency has a legal obligation to protect the investor. So now, ask yourself this question, Helmut. Ask yourself this question. If you as a country technically are paying back a loan of the IMF or the World Bank, because I discovered it's technically the IMF that issues the loans, not the World Bank. They show up together at the same meeting.
Yeah.
So when you go see, what was that thing that Nairo, that the Kenyan guy said?
John Paddy.
Yeah. When you guys get called in
the World Bank IMF annual gatherings.
Yeah. When you get called up to your country's assessment.
Yeah. They even call you by your country, Nigeria.
You go sit in front of a panel that includes both IMF and World Bank. You don't go sit in front of World Bank and then in front of IMF.
Yeah.
Meaning you go speak one thing in front of IMF and one thing in front of World Bank.
Yeah.
Those people sit together.
Yeah.
They share the same data sets with each other. But it's the IMF that approves the borrowing facility.
Yeah.
They approve it. The World Bank just says, yeah, we've got, here's the money. Here's the programs. Here's the initiatives. Here's this. Here's
you
that.
You do the admin work.
Yeah. But then IMF is the one that you will literally, let's say you have the warehouse and you have the shop. The IMF is the shop that you go see.
Mm-hmm.
You don't just go to the World Bank this side. So that aside, the downside is those two guys sit with the same sets of information. Yeah.
Yeah.
When you get called in as a country to come and tell your story, you are telling this one story and being interrogated by two bad cops. So your story gets punched through holes by two interrogators sitting in front of you because they've got to generate data about your country that they now go and give and go publish, you know, freely on their websites and stuff because you can find all that data there on their websites about your country and the likes.
Yeah.
Which then spills over into the next thing. Now, under Donald Trump, the American government wants to do away with this middleman situation.
Mm-hmm.
However, the American banks are the biggest financiers of these borrowing initiatives. I know, dear listeners, we started off on energy investment, but this is literally the discussion. Where does that global money come from? Now, and also, like I highlighted, there's only four central banks that can print money just for the fun of it. They can even go crazy because they know there's someone in Africa that would need money. They can go crazy. They don't even have to justify. Have you guys ever heard the Bank of Namibia practice? Helmut, let me ask you this. Have you ever heard of the Bank of Namibia practicing quantitative easing?
What's that in English?
Quantitative easing is the ability to print the money. Quantitative easing is the ability to push, to stimulate your financial markets, to stimulate supposedly other activities in your economy through printing more money, making money more accessible. No. The Namibian Bank of Namibia has never announced quantitative easing because the moment we announce quantitative easing, meaning printing more money, South Africa will call us and ask us, "Wat vang jy aan? What are you doing?" South Africa cannot also cannot just do quantitative easing.
Yeah.
Because that also means that they need to print money. Because then Namibia will call them and say, what are you doing?
Because you're about to sink and you're going to take my economy along with you.
Exactly. So there's technically only four economies that can do quantitative easing in this planet. It's the United States. It's the United Kingdom. It's the European Central Bank and it's the Bank of Japan. Only four economies can do quantitative easing.
I'm not sure if I asked you this question before, because you know when you say that, and I don't remember if I asked who prints China's money.
The Chinese, but you have to understand there's something known as an international currencies. You can convert any currency into those currencies.
Yeah.
Now, there's only four currencies that you can do that with. However, let me ask you today, Hamoud. Have you ever tried sending money to someone in China?
No, I don't do order with me.
Okay, it's not just about order with me. But you will quickly...
Okay, I don't have a Chinese girlfriend.
Also, possibly not that. But you will realize how difficult it is if you try sending money from Namibia to China directly.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be a hurdle. It's not supposed to be a hurdle. But I'll give you a case in point. In my previous career...
So it's an international systemic hurdle.
It is. And it's associated to that thing that Russia broke away from, the SWIFT system. It's associated to that.
Oh, yeah.
Meaning that transactions have to flow through United States to be recorded. So the US still sees where your country is sending money to. Even you as Helmut sending money to, let's say, a family member that's gone to visit someone in China.
Yeah.
The downside is you can obviously see the unnecessary detour the transaction is taking. Yeah. So the Chinese back in 2015, 2016, with the first term of President Gai Ngoc, the Chinese applied and requested, can the yuan or the renminbi become an international currency? One of the major international currencies. And they were said no. And then immediately after that.
I'm not shocked.
Immediately after that request, it became very difficult to send money from Namibia to China. And it also became very expensive.
That sounds political.
Because they were firstly told, businesses also operating in Namibia, were told that literally now you've got to convert Namibian dollars into US dollars, and then the money has to be transferred, and then it has to be converted from US dollars back to yuan. Now, do you see the unnecessary thing it created for anyone trying to do international business between Namibia and China? Because that means go and request for US dollars. That's the first know your customer requirement.
Yeah.
Exchange Namibian dollars to US dollars and then US dollars to yuan. Now, why didn't they say convert Namibian dollars to South African rand and then rand to yuan?
I'm coming up.
Okay, my turn. Hold on, just let me finish my story. As I was saying, my man, you've been finishing your story for 10 minutes now. Even my chassis is getting warm. Just give it more ice. Anyways, long story short. Oh, hi. When you're talking, it's a short story long. Short stories turn long. Go best together with Tassenberg. Not for persons under the age of 18. Enjoy responsibly.
Tune in to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM, and be part of an in-depth discussion on events you didn't know you needed to hear until you do. From Namibia, Africa, and around the world. Tune in from Monday to Friday from 4:30 to 6 p.m. only on Eagle FM.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any of its staff.
Welcome back. It's just a minute past the hour of 5. You are still listening to Home Run. That's with Helmut and Dwight on Eagle FM. And on the menu today here on Home Run, we're keeping company with the International Energy Agency. So, energy investment report, where they look at how investment, how investment into the energy sector, and this is energy all throughout, not just renewable or non-renewable. This is just energy overall. They looked at it all. Like one of the things that they point out is the International Energy Agency measures investment as assets. For some sectors such as power generation, this investment is spread out evenly from a year in which a new plant or upgrade of existing one takes a final investment decision. That FDI, the final investment decision, is an important one because thanks to Namibia's ongoing oil explorations, basically the emerging oil part of the overall extraction industry, I learned about something known as a final investment decision. Basically, it's a final go or that the investor decides, okay, you know what, I'm convinced or I've done all the necessary math. Basically, the investors, the guys with money, they don't do the math. If they want to know your country's laws, they hire a think tank to study your country inside out. And believe me, those guys are good at it. And if they want to understand your country's economic structure, your economic ins and out, they hire, there are different firms that will just, that offer those services. So, the final investment decision. So, for the International Energy Agency, they track investment from the time of a groundbreaking to the time. Yeah, so the final, investment, they follow it all the way through to the final investment decision, all the way through to the, to the projects, being deemed fully operational. Now, and then they go on to point out that, for other sources such as, upstream oil and, upstream oil and gas and liquefied natural gas LNG projects, investment reflects the capital spending incurred over time as production from the new source ramp up or to maintain output from existing asset. Now, does this mean that when companies like ExxonMobil, Shell, and Total, the oil rig? I think one was one came from the Portuguese. There's a Portuguese oil company.
Galp.
That one.
Another one came from, Norwegians in the North Sea. And then the other one came from an American outfit. One of them is an American company.
Yeah. Now, the thing is, now these guys are just looking at energy overall. That's one thing that I found interesting. That's not shocking. Again, it's the International Energy Agency. They are not looking at a particular source of energy. They are looking at energy overall. Now here's the thing. Africa's, Africa Energy Bank. I haven't been following that financial institution. Last time I was reading up on it, I think it was back in February or March. I remember watching a bunch of videos and basically reading up on their institution for a while. But the reason behind Africa Energy Bank was founded is so they can create a financial pool that will be used to be that will be accessed by those ones that want to invest in Africa's energy sector, irrespective of which energy source. Because it turns out much of the international of the international financial institutions, especially the Western ones, they are reluctant to lend money to someone that's going to invest it into non-renewable energy sources. That is a strict requirement in terms of accessing financing for investment into the energy sector. Is what gave the Afri Exim Bank and one entity, a giant headache that basically decided to, I'm not sure if it's Afri Exim Bank and African Development Bank, but Afri Exim Bank is central to it.
Yeah.
So they decided to come together to come up with that Africa Energy Bank, where Africans that will want to invest into the energy sector that are non-renewable, they can just go to them instead of going to Western financial institutions and sweating buckets to explain why they would want to invest into a source of energy that everyone, at least if you look at it from a United Nations member states standpoint, everyone wants to transition from, as per the Paris agreements. And you cannot actually blame, and at least I can't blame the financial institutions for having that requirement, because, well, if you were, or your country was represented during the Paris climate talks, you had agreements. You signed up to a lot of, transition programs in terms of the energy from non-renewable to renewable ones.
Yeah.
So now you have a little bit of a problem here. Yesterday's discussion was basically centered around energy transition, a part of energy transition, but in modes of transport. But today is not about energy transition. It's about energy investment, and this is energy overall, both renewable and non-renewable. And one thing that we are seeing is that, investment-wise, it's not that, it's not rocket science, at least for countries like Namibia. We have significant non-renewable energy. At least we basically have both renewable and non-renewable energy investment taking place here. We have the oil and gas investments taking place. We have the green hydrogen is one of those non-renewable energy investment that's taking place in our country. So like you said, it's a kind of a little difficult to use us as an example in this because we're a little too squeaky clean.
Yeah, we are too squeaky clean. We are probably the worst example you can ever think of, Hermond. Because it would look
we're the best example.
That's what I'm saying. We're the because according to the explanation that we highlighted, you're supposed to find an example that literally describes what we just described.
Yeah.
Or basically can show a listener this is a bad idea. What was the example of last week, man, back on Friday that I thought about specifically where we highlighted the discussions around, but it was something sorry, it was my Sunday morning talk, on Sunday morning, the history of central banking. So, central banking.
Man, why didn't you invite me?
Well, you wouldn't have been awake at 5 a.m.
Yeah, you're right about that. No way. I wake up at 5 a.m.
You wouldn't have been awake at 5 a.m.
Nope.
So when you look at the history of central banking, some of the banks that we know as banks on the African continent have colonialism roots or have colonial roots.
Is it some or all of them?
Well, mostly of them.
Yeah.
Let me rather say most of them and all of them. The downside of such institutions and such a particular discipline, which is now a core sector to your financial sector in your country, is that this particular institution specifically plays a key role in being connected to the international financial and commodity markets around the world. Weirdly enough, it's not connected per se to the consumer markets of the global consumer market. It is more nuanced in being connected mostly to commodities and financial sectors, meaning it can say if the country needs an IMF loan or an IMF intervention, the central bank is there to respond.
Yeah.
And to find out also literally that after World War One, it is an American idea, an American and a British idea to have central banks in your countries.
Wait, what?
It's an American-British idea to have central banks in the... Guess why? Because just after World War One, they helped. I didn't know Estonia was already divorced from
the Soviet.
No, they weren't even the Soviet Union then. Remember, the Bolshevik Revolution happened in the middle of the First World War.
Yeah.
So the Bolsheviks literally then meant there was a vacuum of power, and then obviously those territories that were in some way attached to Imperial Russia became independent, like Estonia. Finland was also one World War One, technically also an Imperial Russian territory. But Finland was also a contested country, just like Poland, between Sweden and Russia. Poland was obviously between Prussia and then later on Imperial Germany and Imperial Russia. So with that particular scenario after World War One, central banks were now being asked to be these core installations in societies that didn't have central banks to begin with.
Yeah.
Then, after World War II, central banks then became mandatory across the world. They became mandatory across the world because this is literally how your country's economy gets connected to the global economy. So, you can obviously see, Helmut, where the first iterations or the first sort of like idea or template for globalization pops up from. It pops up when everybody, and that's also now recently independence reaching and achieving African countries, realize now they're still going to be connected. Because I watched someone else about not someone else, it was Mahmoud Mamdani, Zoran Mamdani's father, because he's a political science lecturer. And he highlighted primarily, Hamid, there was a time back in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s Africans could compete intellectually. Africans could compete with mechanics. Africans could compete with innovation, healthy and, you know, proper standards of living.
Yeah.
The disconnect literally is, like I keep saying, it's the kind of political leader you vote into or you give power to. It's that guy, that individual that just, you also have to scratch your head and go like, where do we find this guy?
Yeah.
You know, he didn't look like this. He didn't act like this. Where do we find him? So indications like that obviously become the troubling thing. Fast forward, obviously, to today, 2026. We also sit with a scenario of understanding how to create the markets. Creating the markets is central because when that Ali Dangote, not Ali Dangote, what is his MD's name for the refinery, that Australian, the Dangote, when that guy explained literally the week after 28 February, that first week of March.
Yeah.
It's a something Smith guy, man, MD. When he explained to the Nigerian and African media, basically, yeah, David Bird is his name, not David Smith, David Bird. Bird explained the downside is Nigerian oil is produced in Nigeria. The Dangote refinery is in Nigeria. However, the Dangote refinery has to buy the Nigerian oil at an OPEC international US dollar price tag, not at a Nigerian Naira price tag. Instantaneously, Helmut, it throws the whole discussion of getting cheap petroleum products or petrochemicals cheaper anywhere else. Why? Well, Jiang explained it because it's the petrodollar. And then all the economists after that came and explained the petrodollar's particular threat because of what Iran was doing. Shooting at desalination plants, shooting then at refineries or petroleum refining infrastructure and then extraction infrastructure in that neighborhood of block equals block plus block equals unblock philosophy. And the discussion then became very clear, very apparent to everybody that basically Iran is going to war with the global economy.
Yeah.
Because we all have to buy petroleum products at US dollar prices. Which also, if Namibians didn't know this, you now know it again. Once again, it's a song I'll repeat. There's nothing you can do. Namibia has to sit or has to show up at its own allotted time frame for buying petroleum products on the international petroleum products market with US dollars. It cannot show up with Hendrik Witbooi's. It cannot. It has to show up with Benjamin Franklin's. It cannot. The next equivalent, obviously, would be British pound sterling, or it would be the euro. But it's the petrodollar we're talking about. So you have to show up with an equivalent in US dollar. There's nothing we can do. You have to show up with an equivalent in South African rand for US dollar. There's nothing we can do. And Bird highlighted basically, even though the oil is right across the street, for that truck to drive from there to here, we first have to pay the US dollar international price tag per barrel, per liter.
Okay. This is what I have been asking myself. Come again? Anyway, look... I'm terrible with sign language. Try Morse code. Now,
through how am I going to send the Morse code, Helmut?
Yeah. Now, look. The question I've been asking myself is that when you look at the fact that African countries, if you look at their economies, are heavily reliant on the extractive industry. And this extractive industry in terms of ownership, and when I say ownership, I mean who is putting in the money to basically to get the day-to-day operations in terms of getting the job done. Mm-hmm. Most of them are foreign multinational corporations. So take for example, if a Namibian, if there is a if there's a Chinese company that's operating a lithium mine in Namibia, and then there's a Canadian company that wants to buy that lithium, doesn't the transaction take place that side and then they just deliver the product?
Basically, yes.
Now, at this point, is Africa trading with Canada, or is just China and Canada doing the trading?
No, it's China and Canada. It's literally China and Canada.
So now, the thing is, when you look at how reliant, heavily, heavily reliant we are as a continent in the extractive industry, this is what keeps taking place. You have uranium mines that are dominated by multinational giants like Areva, for example, which is French, we don't process any of it. Mm. Yeah. So as soon as they finish,
but we want a power plant.
For the love of God, why? We
want a power plant. Look, it's a wonderful idea, Hamid, literally, but it puts us in close proximity as Namibia to Kuiberg in South Africa.
Yeah.
Kuiberg, yes, is now being refurbished. And when that thing comes on, South Africa can basically say goodbye to any load shedding. Now, SADC, we have the SADC power pool. Does this mean that Namibia wants to increase its share of selling into the power pool? But there's also plans of bringing Angola into the power pool, because Angola literally sits
isolated.
Isolated, plus it sits with excess power,
lot of energy
that it generates. So who needs this, these rapid developments in electricity development? But the other thing is also a question of, it's a good thing, specifically, but it's a question of how are we selling this. And then in between, Namibia has an abundance of renewable energy production. With now, that other article that I wrote, was it 2 months back, about the ECB that highlighted literally that the renewable guys, or the independent power producers, literally want to sell to the international market, to the SADC power pool. They don't want to sell to Namibia at Namibian dollar rates. They want to sell at that US dollar rate.
Look, I totally understand. Well, the meat market does the same thing. If I had a commercial farm and I was approached by two customers, a Namibian and a Norwegian, and they want to buy, who do you think I'll be selling the product to?
They
want to
buy the same quantity.
The same quantity.
But at different denominations. At different currency denominations.
Yeah. Who are you selling?
I'm selling to the Norwegian.
There you go. And
because if that krona comes here, which is on par with the euro, I will say, I almost said something bad, but I will say, horse, I'm going to the bank, guys.
That's good for business. I think this is the dilemma now. We have to choose.
But it creates inflation, Albert.
Yeah, it does. But the thing is, as a business person, your priority is to keep your business running. That means you want to make as much profit as you can.
Exactly.
And
but the downside is now, and this is how inflation is an uncontrollable beast in Namibia, for example.
Yeah.
A block plus block thing happens somewhere else. The central bank can't do anything.
Yeah.
It puts a burden on that mechanism of the Ministry of Mines and Energy. What's that mechanism they use basically to subsidize the petrol price? It puts a pressure on that. There is no quantitative easing that the central bank can play with. We don't have our own oil. Even though people can come and tell me there is oil, please pump the first barrel. Come on, sin as a belief. Show me the oil. Because I have not seen the oil. I'm not hearing of the oil. All I'm hearing is just it's potentially there. So it's Wamkele Mene's theory. We are just potentials. So we don't have the oil. We don't even have the refinery on the ground as yet. Even though Iran said, no, we can come and help you for free. We don't have the thing on the ground.
Okay, but here is one little issue with that. Take, for example, the Iranians, when it comes to the refining technology, they have it, which I find impressive because they've been under sanctions for decades.
Oh, they've got multiple.
No, there you go.
They're not like Kuwait and like UAE and like Qatar and a Bahrain, who just sit with one refinery.
Yeah.
No, they have multiple across the country.
So they have the technology. They can help countries like Namibia.
We don't want the steel.
No, we have a lot of that. But the
we
thing
produce
is,
produce our own and we import steel.
No, the thing is, even if even if the Namibian government separate from the I'm not sure if that to even if we were to say we want a local refinery in Namibia.
Yeah,
is that going to be built, built and then operated after it comes operation? Is that something that will be built and operated by the Namibian government, or it will be in collabo with the oil investors that are investing in Namibia's oil industry? Because that's another discussion. Because they
no,
will
no, I can answer it now.
Okay, please.
Before President Geingob's second term ended back in last year, or at the end of 2024, Minister Alwendo signed that MOU with his Zambian counterpart. Remember the pipeline that I keep talking about?
Yeah.
Where it aims to take a pipeline from the oil and gas, or the oil resource, to Zambia. Now imagine
to be refined in Zambia.
So on the ground, it's two suggestions from two foreign partners. One Iranian in Namibia.
Yeah.
Onshore refining.
Refinery, yeah.
And the second is the Zambian refining outside Namibia with a pipeline connecting from the sea to there across the country.
That's one long pipeline.
It's a massive pipeline. It's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And guess what, Hamoud? There's a lot of people that'll get rich if that thing goes across through their land.
Yeah, lithium mining, illegal mining. Oh, it will be.
Look,
I know a bunch of guys with vrupas that will just drive there, but it's unrefined, it's pointless.
Look, the easiest thing, I still want the Namibian government to literally contemplate literally a dole system, meaning pay every Namibian citizen at the end of every year between 19 and whatever, 100, whatever.
Like the Australians do?
No,
like the Alaskan do.
Pay them an amount of money every year from those oil proceeds. That's it, Helmut. You know we won't be able to fill all the posts. Just last week, we had the discussion in the Villager e-paper. We have a 29-to-1. Remember Thursday's discussion about the green hydrogen discussion?
Yeah.
29-to-1 jobs. So that means there are 28 lost opportunities for Namibians to participate in. Our TVs need to be able to produce 29,000 people just to do construction and installation work, Hamoud. It's not even the science. They're not even at the engineering yet. It's just the construction, just holding the brick, mixing the daga, putting the daga on, putting the brick on, and then making sure it's level. Installation work, the technicians.
Yeah.
That's it. That is it, Hamoud. Doesn't matter what you do. It's just that. So, what do we need? A dole system. We need a basic income grant immediately, generated from the proceeds made here. Namibians will have money here. You'll be driving your own vrupa.
Point of correction. Namib breweries will have a lot of money.
Why? Why?
Because I know Namibians.
That is true.
Yeah.
Look. There'll be a lot of cash. That's all I can say.
The thing is that money will be in circulation.
It'll generate a lot of money.
Yeah.
Plus the money will be in circulation.
In circulation, yeah.
Because remember, all oil transactions take place in
US dollar denominations.
Yeah. So we will immediately sit with the Dutch curse.
Oh boy.
And at the rate of yesterday's discussion of the EV adoption, that means we are late in the race.
Oh no. I will get to that when it comes to how late we in a field.
We are late in the race.
We are not just late.
We are super late.
We are just late for the lack of a better way.
Do you know those goats that sometimes just stand there a little bit extra outside looking at the sun and the last blade of grass that they thought they could chew on, but they know they can't chew on because they're too full, while the others know that they already have to go back to the kraal.
Yeah.
That's how late Namibia is.
If Evie-wise, oh boy, are we late.
Even with Evie's, yeah.
Now, back to the, now on the IEA report, I have two parts of that report I have to read, you know, I want to read out. I'm going to start with Sub-Saharan Africa. So, you know, the reports look at Sub-Saharan Africa in terms of energy investment, and then we'll go to come and point out how squeaky clean Namibia is doing in terms of again energy investment. This is such a relief. Now, in Sub-Saharan Africa, that's on page 34. In Sub-Saharan Africa, investment is set to rise 12% to nearly $24 billion in 2026, following an 18% year-on-year decline since 2025. So now, BP's investment in 2026 is centered on increasing production in Angola and Namibia's Orange Basin.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's us.
Now, that is Namibia. And then it goes on to point out that now LNG supply, the liquefied natural gas, LNG supply development continues in both Nigeria and Mozambique by a variety of majors and local companies. Now, just on the first, I just wanted to put, put a pawn, put a pin. Not put a Mia Khalifa, but anyway. Now,
look! It's a slip of the tongue, guys. It's a slip of the tongue.
Put a pin. Not the other one.
The more you emphasize it, I'm with them.
Oh, I like it though. Now, put a pin on the Sub-Saharan Africa's investment increasing to, increasing to 12%.
Yeah.
Then you go to page 30, you go back to page 33. The page 33 is the one that talks about very squeaky clean Namibia. A thin inventory of de-risked greenfield project is concentrated in a few countries: Namibia, Guyana, Brazil, and Suriname. These are greenfield projects. That basically means this is a new energy infrastructure setup.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, the reason why I said put a pawn on on that 12% increase is that if you go on the website of the International Energy International Energy Agency, one thing that they are pointing out is that as with previous energy shocks, I think they are now emphasizing that the projections that was made in terms of increase in investment, especially in Africa, and download the report, you run into this somewhat of a disclaimer that they are pointing out that as with previous energy shocks, many impact will become visible only later. Around 3/4 of anticipated energy investment in 2026 are based on decisions made well before the Middle East conflict began.
Yep.
In other words, we made projections on how everything is going to go okie-dokie, but with the ongoing conflict in the Middle East, it's hard to tell where things are going.
Oh. Let me also tell you what we thought we knew, what we did not know at the time even of the Russia-Ukraine conflict.
Yeah.
So, Jai Shankar recently was in another discussion. And, okay, the context of the discussion was based upon, is the United States a reliable international relations member in 2026? And Jai Shankar said literally... which is now sort of like the two opposing narratives that now come about specifically of what happened in right after 2022 when the conflict broke out and Russian oil was now to be sanctioned. And remember all that pressure that India was experiencing about don't buy Russian oil.
Yeah.
Jai Shankar said literally on that one panel, we were asked by the Americans, please buy Russian oil. Why? To stabilize the global oil pricing. Helmut? Did we know this? No, we did not know this. Did we know that the Americans knew that if they influence OPEC, because technically Russia and Saudi Arabia are the two largest oil producers, and yeah. Venezuela, they were the three largest oil producers for OPEC. Just for Jai Shankar literally to say this back in last week, because so many platforms were hosting it, I had to try and find where was the original platform that he spoke about this particular development, and he made this particular comment. And he literally said, back in 2022, when the conflict broke out, the Americans asked the Indians, please buy on the international market Russian oil just to stabilize, not just supply, but also to stabilize international energy prices, which is basically transportation affiliated to the petrochemical sector. Did we know this? No, we did not know this. We knew that the Indians were buying Russian oil.
Yeah.
But we didn't know that there was a request, behind a motivation from a motivation. We didn't know this as a global citizen of this planet.
Yeah.
Another dimension also, Helmut, had been, for example, who is actually the world's biggest consumer, meaning that has the largest oil reserves, strategic oil reserves, is Japan. The same agency that we cite here for today's particular discussion, the International Energy Agency, it's not a UN-affiliated agency, just so that our listeners know, but what they do is literally they are bringing much of these energy, specifically the countries, they're bringing the countries together to assess global energy trends. Basically, it's that. It's not a UN-affiliated, but so far they are the guys that have been leading the discussion in terms of assessments, trend analysis, consumption analysis, policy analysis, and even broad bringing ministers together. However, at the start of this year with that conflict, 28 February, when they asked member nations to participate in releasing strategic oil reserves into the global market, it wasn't China who had the largest. It wasn't the United States that had the largest. It wasn't even... Russia's not part of them. It wasn't even, what's the country's name? It wasn't even India. It was literally Japan that released the most of its strategic oil reserves. Japan. Now, everybody's now sitting up straight and going like, yay. Since when did an island nation have the largest strategic oil reserves? And releasing the largest specifically. Now, if you release that much, Ahmed, this means that you need to refill it back.
Yeah.
So they obviously were calculating and planning. So where are we going to get to refill what we just released into the global oil markets?
Yeah.
Where are we going to get to refill again? So obviously they are buying again.
Yeah.
So obviously this means that there was a lot of economic activity, you know, just purchasing happening between these countries that released strategic oil reserves. And in between, obviously, what was that ridiculous statistic I read just literally as the conflict began? The one
ridiculous
about
statistics.
Yeah, the one about Putin. People love their narratives. You know, these Western journalists about Russia making something like $790 million a day.
Jeez,
it's a lot of money. It's a lot of money. It's a lot of money. A day, just from what that conflict created there.
Mm-hmm.
Because now everybody need oil, and Iran is going with a kamikaze move here, going like, okay, my bro, if this is the way you want to do things, well, nobody's going to sell oil in this neighborhood. And so, that ghost fleet of Russia, that is just sailing around the world,
gets into business.
Their cargo gets bought. So that technically means everybody was buying. But here's the thing. America is not buying from the international market. America is not buying from the international market. And that is...
Oil?
No. That's what Jiang highlighted with the game theory discussion. But it's also what... what's the guy's name?
the other economists.
Wait, aren't they like drilling most of it and then selling it to the Middle Eastern guys for refinement and then buying refined ones?
No. What the Americans are doing is the Americans, they scaled back on drilling in theirs, but they are building up strategic reserves for mm-hmm. their sectors, their industries.
Yeah.
The downside is the Americans are not buying from any of the other oil-producing countries because the Americans also have oil. They have their oil. So what you can see here through another lens is specifically, and this is not the game theory lens, is specifically it seems like America wants the rest of the world to suffer. Conflicts, you know, by allowing Israel to do what Israel did on 28 February to attack first, to strike Russia, Iran first,
yeah.
by sanctioning Russia for what it did, for what it's doing then the east of Ukraine, by attacking Venezuela and destabilizing Venezuela, by destabilizing Libya, by destabilizing Syria, by destabilizing Iraq, which is right next door to Iran. So the picture starts looking complicated when the rest of the world sits back and goes like, it's this global oil market looks like a mess. Because all of this is about destabilizing OPEC. And America is not part of OPEC. Canada is also not part of OPEC. Australia is not part of OPEC. Who's the other oil-producing country that's part of
OPEC?
That's not part of OPEC. Norway is not part of OPEC. The UK is not part of OPEC. There's someone else, man, that has oil. Brazil. Brazil is part of OPEC, I think. No, Brazil is not part of OPEC. But Portugal is not an oil-producing country. They've got an oil company. Where does Galp operate mostly? But OPEC literally is represented by developing nations. Majority. Minus Russia. You can literally count the whole Arabic kingdoms, the sultanates, as being developing countries. I mean, when you look at this particular illustration, Helmut, you sit with a discussion of like, okay, so it's deep about destabilizing a global south initiative, basically, where these guys are actually determining a global price for everybody, but yeah. supporting the US dollar, supporting the petrodollar discussion. Okay. The next perspective that you've got to look at is currently the whole of the OPEC nations know that they've got to move away from oil production. Everybody knows they've got to move away from oil production. But there's only one country that's against moving away from oil production. And that's the United States. There's only one country that's against it. Even the Saudis know they've got to move away from oil production. Even the UAE that hosted a conference of parties was a 28. I read up now just recently about the 30 by 30 because the comment of 30 by 30 came up once again in the World Oceans Day celebration where across the world.
We haven't looked at that.
Yeah, we haven't looked at it. Where we've got to conserve at least 30% of ecosystems around the world from water-based to air-based to land-based ecosystems and food, you know, everything, all ecological systems, at least 30% have to be preserved. And another dimension of that is literally that policy that we looked at, Helmut, last year, that joint policy by the Ministry of Environment and Industries, Mines and Energy, the one about exploring for mining activities in protected areas.
Yeah, the one that went with Wele.
You know, we are two ministries together, but it's actually for these guys.
Yeah, it depends on
on whose perspective? Yeah. On what perspective? Not whose.
Yeah. That is confusing the heck out of me in terms of the oil import and export for the US.
Are the Americans importing?
Yeah, according to World Population Review, a whole lot of it.
Iraq. Oh, yeah.
Wait, Iraq?
Yeah, they've got Iraq there. They've got Colombia there, which is also funny.
Yeah, I thought the Iraq part was funny, but now that you mentioned Colombia.
No, 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 Helmut. They are importing. They are importing. No. But, okay, just correction, what Helmut just showed me, dear listeners. The Americans do import oil. They do import oil. But the strategy seems like it being one of you use up your resource.
By selling it to me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You use up your resource. We will maintain, conserve, and keep it in, like, in the back pocket here. The downside of what this shows is literally.
Yeah.
Is that this science of, this engineering and science of green hydrogen will come online, Helmut. Namibia does not need oil. That's what I keep saying. Namibia will not need oil. Oil is a dirty business. Oil, Event Horizon, Deep Horizon.
Well, we...
Event Horizon was the sci-fi by Lawrence Fishburne.
About
the horror, the sci-fi horror, basically.
No, deep sea horizon type of accidents. I mean, those ones are going to happen even with the renewable energy. Especially.
What, the sun frying you a little bit too hard?
The hug of life that took place in the Netherlands when those two engineers were.
Oh, the guys that were stuck on
that
the...
were stuck on the wind turbine and that thing was on fire.
Yes, Hamoud. Here's the thing. And nobody could get to those two guys there.
Yeah.
Not even a helicopter.
No. That's the most painful video I ever watched.
They were supposed to have their own safety harnesses to get off.
No, safety harness? That thing was on fire. They were supposed to, I don't know, parachutes? I don't know.
Well, no net. The guy is supposed to climb up and climb down. Not climb up and emergency fly off.
Well, that's the key word you just mentioned. In the event of an emergency, just, pull this lever and say goodbye to the fire. But, now, the thing is, there are two ways that I can connect, yesterday's discussion and today's discussion. And I just can't help but keep bringing them together.
Mm.
Because, the International Energy Agency looked at, EVs from, multiple, perspectives. Number one, they looked at, production.
There's no African perspective. So that so Namibians know. We are there with that negligible data, Hamut, the other and the rest of the world.
We are in a category I like to describe as a DSTV. So much more. And et cetera. But look, the thing is,
it's there somewhere. It's that data set is there somewhere.
Whose idea was it to bring these cameras in here? But look.
You know he's listening. You know he's listening.
I know.
Yeah. So,
yeah. Look.
You were still saying on the negligible.
Yeah, on the negligible. They looked at obviously, part of the technology that is on high demand are the batteries.
Yes.
Yeah. So, the batteries are made out of lithium. Yes. And lithium is something that Africa has a lot of, especially Zimbabwe. So, in other words, and these are electric cars. Electric cars means, obviously you need a lot of rare earth metals to, to make that thing.
And but when you, copper,
a lot of copper, which again, Zambia has a lot of. And, now, when you look at each and, for most of the pieces on an electric vehicle, when you just trace the primary source of the product that of the resources the product is made out of, all roads lead to Africa.
Yeah.
So we are participating in the in a very raw natural resource supply form. As soon as it leaves the ground and is on a ship, we are left out of the equation.
We're not out of the equation, Ahmed, because
we don't process it and then build finished products out of it.
Because we will use that product later on.
So we only show up on the consumption part.
And we show up at the production part.
Yeah, that's where I said...
extraction, not production. Extraction. Yeah,
so we are in extraction and consumption.
Yeah.
So
everything in the middle,
doesn't exist.
It sounds like arranged marriage. Because you skip the whole, will you marry me? Can we go out on a date? And just go straight
and
to...
And you see her without makeup on. And...
Must be scary. And anyway...
Please, dear ladies, I said that, not Helmut. Okay, now, I didn't say that it must be scary part. That's Helmut.
Camera's still on me, man. Anyway, now look. the thing is, from extraction. From extraction, Africa is participating in a lot of manufacturing of a lot of products. And so in the processing and the building finished products out of the processed raw materials, Africa is nowhere near. But this is the value addition part. This is the employment creation part.
It is the local content.
It's the local content part.
It is the it's the minerals beneficiation part.
But we are not participating in that. And so that's why now there's so much more part of the EV EIA discussion that I said, you know, where we are thrown in, where we are part of, there's so much more part. It's the emerging market part.
Yeah.
Yeah. We are part of that.
We are definitely. We are the new frontiers.
Exactly. We have now, instead of us being the new frontier at value addition and processing and manufacturing of processed raw material into finished products, we are not the frontiers in that. We are frontiers at the consumption discussion, which is very painful because now the thing is, at least just the battery, just make the battery. And one thing that, you know, apart from the, there are basically three main manufacturing discussion that was centered around the EV discussion. Mm. One, manufacturing of the whole car itself, or the vehicle itself, or the infrastructure that's needed for the vehicle, in the environment that this vehicle will be operated in. You're talking about your charging points, for example.
Yeah.
So, even if
I saw that charging port, the one that's at City of Windhoek's office.
Uh-huh.
It stands weirdly alone there by itself.
Yeah, that's how isolated the.
Yeah, I tried looking for the ones that are supposed to be at the one mall, the mall in Kleine Cooper.
Yeah,
I have not seen it.
Now you have.
After we did that story in 2025. In the e-paper, I have not seen it.
Now, when you look at it from whether you can talk about this this subject from manufacturing of a car itself, or manufacturing of a car battery, or the car batteries, or the infrastructure, aka charging ports or charging stations that's needed into the quote unquote frontier emerging markets that this mode of transport is rapidly being adopted into, my fear is that we have. Internal combustion engines that are dependent on foreign multinational service stations.
Yeah.
My fear is because of our lack
and
of
supplying and supplying the fuel.
Also supplying the fuel. Yeah. We're just
and the grease products.
It's a terrible picture. But I think what's happening because of our lack of participation into the EV market in terms of the value addition aspect of things and processing and manufacturing is my fear is we are going to wake up 10, 20 years down the line with all the, with all the fuel service stations or fueling stations replaced with charging stations again owned by foreign multinationals.
I hope not, Helmut. I literally hope not.
Now, the technology is still being perfected.
Yeah.
Now, one thing is, take batteries, for example. For batteries, not really batteries, just the charging infrastructure. The charging infrastructure, the technology is still under development, mostly in making it charge faster.
Yeah.
So, as we speak, you have a lot of countries, especially developed countries, that are pouring millions, if not billions, into the research and development to make the charging faster. When they have that breakthrough, they're going to patent it. So that means unless we are investing into charging stations, which would be, I don't know how that would be, instead of investing in batteries and the car, we just go straight to the charging stations. We are going to end up, you know, we are going to end up, you know, with a situation where the technology will be there, but it will be ring-fenced with patents and intellectual property information that you are not going to have to access it. Take the technology that's used with fueling station, for example. Mm. Each and every single part of that nozzle has an intellectual property.
Yeah.
Now, you can't just copy it and start multiplying for your own use.
Well, Helmut, it's also the particular concern that exists today as we speak. I just put in $70 and my scooter's petrol tank is full. A full tank. Even the petrol attendant asked me, so how long does this $70 last you? I said, this can last me a good 5 days of driving before I have to put fuel in again. So for 5 days, I can drive my routes, and then I'm done. And that $72 that I just put in to fill it up completely, imagine now having a 4-seater V8 engine at $1,000, $2,000 Namibian dollars just to fill that car up for its weeks, particular routes that the owner of the car has to drive. And then imagine a 4-cylinder car, 1.2, 1.4 cubic centimeters engine size, requiring between $500 and $800 Namibian dollars just to fill for the week. But that $500 to $800 literally means by Thursday, you know, you'll have to refill. Because people are switching on air cons, people are listening to the radio. Yes, please continue listening to the radio during your drive time session. People are listening to the radio, lights are on, all that, air con is on. So everything from the car producing energy is based upon the fuel. The fuel has to produce all these energy outputs. But before we continue, Helmut, we quickly have to take a short live read and we come back right after this.
Yeah.
The Vita University for the NQA approval for expansion of scope. The Vivitcha University is pleased to inform all stakeholders that the Namibia Qualifications Authority NQA Council has approved our application for expansion of scope. This approval grants accreditation for the following NQF registered qualifications offered through full-time blended learning mode at our university. The following courses are Bachelor of Laws Honours, Bachelor of Education in Secondary Education Honours, Bachelor of Education in Senior Primary Education Honours, Bachelor of Social Work Honours, and the Diploma in Legal Studies Level 6. Vivitcha University, where everyone is an achiever. So yeah, so the fuel source is the key thing that stems from this. Now, I threw in the curveball, obviously, of the green hydrogen sector because of the power to X discussion. The power to X aims to produce fuels.
Yeah.
Jet fuel for planes, potential plastic made from the synthetic fuel, and so on and so on and so on and so forth going ahead. The concern, obviously, has been that we've obviously seen what happens when block plus block equals unblock impacts fertilizer trade in Strait of Hormuz. And fertilizer is also going to be one of the byproducts of the green hydrogen sector. So Namibia literally stands on the cusp of seeing greater benefits being generated and accrued from the green hydrogen participation, or the green industries participation, as it now has been labeled by the NIPDB, that it's now green industries overall to encompass all developments of green energy development, green fuels development, so on and so forth. What we don't see is how does Namibia literally decouple from petroleum? Is there going to be a decoupling?
There will be once we have managed to make our money from our money, right? The money is for investors. So
you remember what you explained, Helmut, about after oil has been drilled or the exploration has ended, a plug has to be put into that where that former well was, right? And obviously, the time frame is the biggest thing because countries like China and India are envisaging by 2060, by 2050, both of them respectively, would then be decoupling and scaling out or moving away from petroleum.
Yeah, but you know one thing, one thing that we are not going to get away from anytime soon is a lot of products that that are made from petroleum.
Yeah.
Like the plastics industry is not going anywhere anytime soon.
Yeah. It's not running away.
It's not going any. So that means the oil and gas, especially crude oil. Take for example, crude oil. And this is the trap actually. And I never actually thought of it this way. Even with all electric cars, we're going to need roads. And I don't think you are going to drive an electric car in a gravel road. Because that's not going to end well.
Yeah.
So that means you are going to need a lot of tarred roads. Because of that thing is basically built with electronic components all the way through. So, a lot of shaking, which is, gravel roads are known for, it's just going to damage a bunch of it.
Yeah.
So that means we are going to need a lot of roads that are made out of tarred roads, which will have to be under constant maintenance. That means you will always need tar. Now, here's the trap. Tar is the last byproduct of the fractional distillation of crude oil. That means when you heat crude oil, all your propane and your octane and all the tane basically evaporates and they are collected on in their respective containers. Until at the end of the whole thing, that's when you are going to get your tar. That, in other words, even if we, we brought Thanos here and then, he snapped and instead of making a bunch of people disappear, he switched every vehicle from the internal combustion engine to electric ones.
Yeah.
We will have to drill crude oil and then refine it all the way through. Get rid of the diesel, which will be at that point now is most likely going to be a waste product. Your petrol is going to be a waste product. Your paraffin is going to be a waste product because the main product that you want is the final product, which is the tar that you will basically is it a bitumen. I think that's the formal name. That's the one that will be used now to cover the roads, hence tarred road. So here's the thing. Even at the height of our adoption of electric vehicles,
we will still not be
the oil and gas industry will still be running because we're gonna unless we have to figure out a different way, a different material of making roads that will replace tarred roads because I totally understand we're still in the transition and baby steps, but we're still in the engine part, and we have figured out the engine part. So let's just transition from, we have figured out the engine parts. Basically, most electric cars have a motor instead of that hunk of metal you call an engine.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, that part of the transition is partly successful. And I'm saying partly successful because even electric cars need plastics for their mostly for the insulations. That's another problem. So that means until we figure out a different source of plastics will be a significant part of electric cars themselves, which are central to our energy transition. So as much as I hate to point it out, getting rid of crude oil is not going to be easy. So I would say Namibia, worry not.
You'll still be able to make money, guys.
You'll still be able to make money. So, just 2 minutes into business and economic segment, that is David's time. So, energy-wise, in terms of investment, we are doing well, sparkling well. It's us and Guyana, and I had to look up Guyana, and they are multiple of them. So now I have to, we have to disappear and make room for David with the business and economic segment. Until tomorrow, same time, same place, you're on your favorite radio station, Eagle FM. You all have a good one.
Ciao, guys.
Tune in to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM, and be part of an in-depth discussion on events you didn't know you needed to hear until you do. From Namibia, Africa, and around the world, tune in from Monday to Friday from 4:30 to 6 p.m. only on Eagle FM.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any staff.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional, and church events. And basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM,
the eye. Oshafafa na nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana. Onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka. Okone ushendi fenawa nukumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge kwata fano na Monica ko Eagle FM. Onore tatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile ko berewa, nora hetatu natu, bali o hetatu matatu, o mafilane, Eagle FM, the eye.